Hagman and Hagman Report. So pleased, so honored to have as our guest Jonathan Kahn, a very prolific author, best-selling author of The Harbinger, The Mystery of the Shemitah, and now The Book of Mysteries, requirement for all libraries across the world. So wherever you're at in the world, grab a hold of your copy of The Book of Mysteries by Rabbi Kahn. You will not be disappointed, and it's unlike any other book. It's hard to describe, but again, I feel like I got a shot of B12 wisdom, and that's just the way it speaks to Mr. Kahn's writing, his writing abilities, but also the content rich. Before we get back to Mr. Kahn, let me ask you something, folks. Have you gone to MinutemanStove.com yet? Have you gone to MinutemanStove.com? If you haven't done so, I would urge everyone to go to MinutemanStove.com. Take advantage of their specials. The Minuteman Rocket Stove is what they offer. It's a perfect survival cooking stove for you and your family for a number of reasons. I'm not going to list them all, but it is a stove that makes the most out of whatever you have, sticks and twigs. It doesn't require that much, just a small amount of fuel to, even if you live in the city or suburb, you can find fuel for your Minuteman stove. And the stove is fully insulated with ceramic refractory insulation. You can actually put it on top of a car, put it on your picnic table. The outside only gets to 200 degrees. The inside, oh yeah, the inside just bakes. Now, when you're using the Minuteman stove, you'll notice that it creates no smoke. It's virtually smokeless, which surprised me. I don't know why, but look, folks, I'm not an outdoorsy kind of guy, okay? You know, I get off pavement, I get lost. So, but this won't give away your location if you're concerned about that, or even bothering others. It's self-contained, it seals airtight for travel storage. We can actually use it and put it in the back of our vehicle. It doesn't stink up the vehicle. It's the only self-contained rocket stove on the market. That's MinutemanStove.com, MinutemanStove.com. Again, proud to offer that through the Hagman and Hagman Report. Again, our guest is Rabbi Jonathan Kahn. And, you know, I just noticed, I'm going to give a shout-out to Leslie and Christy and Nancy and others who responded to our Facebook posting promotion of this show. Thank you so much for joining us, your kind comments. And Mr. Kahn does have a Facebook page as well. Let's use the system given to us to spread the word. And isn't that something we can, while we still can. So, Joe, I'm going to kick it over to you.
Yeah, again, we're talking with Jonathan Kahn, his latest book, The Book of Mysteries. It's a fantastic book that goes through 365 mysteries, and one of the most beautiful mysteries of the ages and revealed in this new book. And I also saw this separate on your website, Jonathan, is The Mystery of the Bridegroom. Can you get into this a little bit?
Yeah, the mystery of the bride and groom, and it's really the mystery behind the Bible. I mean, you know, to begin with, from beginning to end, it's a mystery. It's a mystery that is prophetic, that it gears right into the end times, and it's a mystery that's personal because it has to do with every reader, every person, and God. It goes from in the book, I believe this is one of the streams. It's actually a mystery that happens that keeps developing, getting bigger and bigger, where the teacher takes the traveler down to a tent village in the where they live in the desert, as in the days of the Bible, pretty much, and there are those who still do. And he takes them to witness basically the biblical marriage, the Hebrew marriage, because the Hebrew marriage is what contains this mystery. When the Lord talked about marriage, he was talking about the wedding, talking about the Hebrew marriage, and so it is so awesome what's in there, and that is in the Hebrew marriage, and throughout the book you're kind of taking part in the wedding as you see it. And that is that in order for it to begin, the bridegroom had always to make a journey from the house of the bridegroom to the house of the bride, always, and had to make that journey, go to her house, had to be received in, and then there he would pledge his love to her by offering up a treasure for her, called in Hebrew the mohar, a treasure. And she would have to, if she was, she would have to accept it or not, and if she accepted, they would share a cup of wine together and enter into a covenant. They'd be pledged to each other. And then at that point, they were considered a husband and wife, but they wouldn't see each other because he would go back to where he came from, and he would journey back, and he would there spend the year. They'd be separate at least a year. He would spend the time preparing a home for his new future bride, and the bride would spend the year getting ready to say goodbye, to leave her the house of her childhood, and get ready, become a bride, get beautiful, and all that. And so the thing is, then the wedding day would come. It would usually often take place at night, and the bridegroom would come with dressed as a king with his groomsmen and holding torches and a great procession with the village, and they would come wherever, however far they had to make. They made the journey. It was the second journey, and he would come to the bride one more time. They'd stand face to face. She would take off her veil. They would see each other, and then they would be lifted up on this sedan chair and carried away by this great throng, this great crowd of people celebrating as they made the journey from the house of the bride to the house of the bridegroom. And they would, as they got there, the bridegroom's house would be prepared, and they would receive them in, and they would sit under the canopy or the huppah, and they would, as king and queen, and then they would share the cup of wine again, and then go into a chamber separately and become one. That is the bride and groom. That's the Hebrew marriage, the Bible's marriage. Well, the mystery is this. God, throughout the Bible, God is the bridegroom. We are the bride, or we are created to become the bride, and that's why we're always empty until we find him. We try to marry ourselves and join ourselves to other things. But then, in order for the mystery to happen, for the marriage, the bridegroom has to make that journey from his house to the house of the bride. So, according to the mystery, 2,000 years ago, God makes the journey from his house to our house, from heaven to earth to Israel, and ultimately to our lives. He's the God who comes to us. We don't get to him. He comes to us. He knocks on the door. We have to receive him in. And what does he do? The bridegroom, according to the mystery, has to offer a pledge, a treasure for the bride to set her free from her house. Then he offers that while he's in her house. So what happened 2,000 years ago? It's called the Mohar. He offered up the Mohar, which was his own life. That is the bridal price. And that's what sets us free. And then we are considered pledged or consecrated. You know, there's a covenant, a cup of wine, just as Messiah did. And then, according to the mystery, the groom has to go back to his house and leave her house. So Messiah left her house. He's got to prepare a place. He said, I have to go now, but I'm going to prepare a place for you. And where I am, you're going to come. I'm going to come back and take you to myself. And so what happens? So now is the time of the separation. He's there. We're here. But we have to be preparing for that day. That's why the Bible, at the end of Revelation, it's all wedding. It's the wedding day, and then it's the joining of God and men. And so the end of prophecy, it's a wedding. So the final thing comes, there'll be one more journey, which is the second coming of the bridegroom, and he will journey this time not humbly, but in glory as a king, will come by night, torchlight. We need to be ready, and he will take us into the house of the bride, the kingdom, ultimately to heaven. And whether we're alive for that day in prophecy, or whether we all, it's when we meet him, when we're finished with this life, it'll be the same thing. He'll take us to the house of the bridegroom, what we dreamed of, and for the first time in our lives, we'll be home.
Fantastic, Jonathan. You alluded to this earlier about how things can be lost in translation between the original scriptures that are written in Hebrew versus the English language, in which I would urge everybody to get a concordance and a good program on the computer is the eSword program. You can download it for free. You can get the concordance for free and get these translations, because so much happens to be lost in translation. As you said, a lot of the words have a lot more meaning behind them than the English language allows for.
There's a lot of Hebrew mysteries, a lot of things from the Bible you just could not, because there's no one word that could capture it. There's a thing called the mystery of the divine pluralities, and I mentioned one when I mentioned Elohim, but the fact is there's several, and there's only a handful, but of these peculiar words in the Bible that in the original language have these unique qualities that they are written only in the plural. And one of them is, we talk about God having mercy and love for us, but in the Hebrew he doesn't. He only has mercies, rachamim, which or loves, meaning what it's saying is the love of God, the mercy of God is so big, so great, you can't contain it. The word for sin is singular, but the word for his love and mercy is plural. So it means no matter how much sin we have, there's always more love, more mercy. You can never exhaust it. You can never come to the end of it. And all these, the interesting thing is, as you get to the end of the latter part of the book, these different mysteries of pluralities, they end up coming all together in heaven. Because when you look at the vision of heaven in the Bible, it's all these particular words that are peculiar of pluralities, they all come together in heaven, because there's no end of heaven. It goes on. You can't contain it. But there's one word which, when you read Isaiah 53 about the Messiah dying for our sins, you wouldn't see it, because this didn't have to be written like it, but it is. It's a peculiarity. When you read it, it says he died, it says, with a rich man in his death. But in Hebrew, in the original language, it doesn't say that. You won't see it in Hebrew, but in the original it says, with a rich man in his deaths, plural. In other words, Messiah didn't die one death. He died all of our deaths. In the Hebrew, it's there. And not only that, but the Hebrew means that the death that he died for us is so gigantic, though even the word death cannot contain it. That's how much he loved us.
That's fascinating. Moving along here, Jonathan, this is one that I have not read in the book yet, but this is intriguing to me. What is the ninth of Av mystery, and how does it reveal the mystery behind the existence of America?
Man, this blew my mind. I mean, really.
Yeah. There is a mystery. There's a day in the Bible called the ninth of Av, and on that day, I mean, God is so perfect and precise. The first temple of Jerusalem was destroyed on the ninth of Av by Babylon. The second temple was destroyed by the Romans hundreds of years later on the same exact day, the ninth of Av. And then when you look through Jewish history, you find that all these great calamities take place on the same day. The for instance, when the Jewish people were thrown out of, expelled from England, ninth of Av. Expelled from France, ninth of Av. Expelled from Spain, ninth of Av. The Holocaust, ninth of Av. So all these things. But then there's the tenth of Av mystery, and that, there's another thing in there. One of the mysteries is called the tenth of Av, and that is that whenever God brings judgment, there's always a hope. There's always a redemption that He's planning. I mean, the first thing's over, then He's planning the old covenant, and He's planning a new covenant. So the tenth of Av is sort of the beginning of the redemption, or beginning when He's planning something. So here's the thing: this is linked to the very existence of America itself. Is linked to this ancient Hebrew mystery, the timing, the very beginning of American civilization. And here's the thing. On the 9th of Av, years ago in Spain, the Jewish people were fleeing for their lives. They were expelled from Spain. It was one of the greatest tragedies in Jewish history, because it was their major refuge was Spain. So they had to get out or be killed, so they're fleeing the harbors, they're fleeing the ships, they're fleeing they're just out of there. But in the same exact harbor, well, let me tell you, the year that they had to get out was the year 1492. The month was August, and so in the same harbor, three of those ships were the Nina, the Pinta, and the Santa Maria. These two events of world history are happening at the exact same time, not by accident. It's according to the mystery. And that is that in the same harbors, same land, same year, same month, same week. So the Jewish people are, the greatest tragedy happens that the ninth of Av. But on the 10th of Av, the next day, the three ships set sail to discover America. Now, what is America? In other words, when the greatest refuge was lost for the Jewish people, God was, at that very day, He begins what will become America, which will be the greatest refuge of the Jewish people in the future. The greatest refuge. So even America's existence itself goes back to the ancient mystery that goes all the way back to the destruction of the temple in 586 BC.
Wow. Only fitting if we can move here next, day 54, the mystery nation, while we're talking about nations.
Yeah, well, that you know, there is one nation on earth that, in a nutshell, that defies every law of history, every law of logic, one nation. Like, if you came from another planet and you looked at the earth and you said, you know, wait, there's something, you'd say there's something going on here with this nation, and that is that. I mean, while every other nation passes away, every great power passes away, there's one nation that keeps on going no matter what, and that is the nation of Israel, the very nation that God put on the earth. It's eternal by God's word. So there's no way. He said, you know, so when you see, you know, you go to a museum today, you go to New York, where I'm around, where we are, go to a museum, you'll see all the great empires that were so great back then, and Egypt, Assyria, and they're gone. They're nothing. There's nothing. They're stone. But in the same museum, you'll see Jewish people walking around, because they're alive. You know, every nation that tried to destroy the Jewish people is gone. I mean, is gone or fell or empire fell, but the nation of Israel lives because the God of Israel lives. So the proof, one of the major proofs of God on earth is very simply that, that the Jewish people, after all hell tried to destroy them for 4,000 years, they were as alive as they ever were. Israel is right in the center of the news as much as it ever was, because the God of Israel is real, the word of God from Israel is real, the Messiah of Israel is real, and therefore we live because of that. So that's the right, that the Israel is the mystery nation.
Yes, it is. And when I read that opened my eyes, and it's so very true. And all the nations that did come against Israel are gone, but Israel and its people are still around.
If I can just pun in here a little bit, to me, when I read the Bible, I mean, I think I've got a pretty good understanding of things, but it's nice to read books like the Book of Mysteries, where this, at least for me, broadens my horizons a little bit, and it actually acts as like a counselor. I mean, the book is my is going to become my companion to the Bible, because it complements and enriches my understanding of the Bible. That's just me, but I think I have to believe that would have the effect. Other people would see that as an effect of this book.
Well, that's, and then when you tell me that, I mean, is, this is because it's the first week, it just came out, this is where I'm getting, beginning to get all these things back from as we're reading it. And that's the best thing I can hear. That's it, it's to be more than just, hey, you're reading something,
Yeah, and so in that vein, mission accomplished. Now, if we can go here, and if you don't want to go here yet, you can let us know. I want to be respectful of your time. You have, we spoke earlier about the prophetic update on events taking place linked to the Shemitah. Now, you brought us the mystery of the Shemitah, but many people are asking this, and I'll ask this on their behalf. What is the mystery of the Shemitah? Not the Shemitah, but the Shemitah.
Oh, okay.
is that all right? Or again,
it is totally right. Yeah, I have an update on the Shemitah if you want.
Okay, we'll start wherever first. Wherever makes sense.
Okay, I'll do that, and then I'll get into the Shemitah.
Okay.
Yeah, well, here, now, remember, I mean, the last of the Shemitah of 2008, and you have the actual day of the Bible, Elul 29, the day when everything has to get wiped out, and on that was September 29th, 2008, and you have the greatest wipeout in the financial realm in stock market history, in Wall Street history, on the exact day down to as the closing bell. Well, that has been the greatest day, and it still is the greatest day of Wall Street. And the one before it, well, that was also on the Shemitah, on the exact day. But the greatest crash since then in the world, as far as a world crash, happened just this summer when Great Britain withdrew from the European Union, as you remember, and the global markets just totally crashed. It was the worst crash since September 29th, the day of the Shemitah in 2008. Well, now here's the thing: if you in the Bible, the Shemitah was linked to God's timing. It was the 70 years in judgment in Babylon were linked to the timing of the Shemitah. It's linked to timing, and timing of calamities. Well, if you take the moment that Shemitah of September 29, 2008, when you on the actual day when you have the greatest wipeout in history, and the number that it's the day of sevens, it's the seventh, the end of the seventh year, and how much was wiped out? 777.7 points. I mean, 7.7. Now, if you go back from that day, and you go back by those numbers from that exact moment, you go back 7 biblical years, it'll take you exactly to the closing bell of September 17th, 2001, right after 9/11, and you have the other greatest crash in world history to that date. It was the greatest crash at the time, and so down to the closing bell, 7 years. But then, if you go back another seven, it's 7 days, the seventh day will take you to an interesting day. It'll lead you to 9/11. And it'll lead you to actually 4 p.m., 9/11, because that's the closing bell. Then if you go back 7 hours, It leads you to 9 o'clock on 9/11, which is the hour of the of 9/11. And then if you go back two sevens of minutes, it takes you to 8:46, which is the actual minute of 9/11. Now, what happens if you go the other way? What happens if you go in the future? You take the same exact moment, this is September 29, 2008, the Shemitah moment, 777.7, and go forward in time. 7 years, 7 months, 7 weeks, and 7 days. Where does it take you? It takes you to Friday, June 24th, 2016, the day of England, of Brexit, and the other greatest crash in world history. The exact day. And even secular newspapers noted that, that's what, something's going on. There are articles about this, linking that the moment of 777.7 on Wall Street, taking it to the bread. They didn't know about the Shemitah, and they didn't know about the other one before it, but even they recognized it. So even in that, the pattern has been exact.
God's fingerprints. I mean, God's fingerprints. I don't know how else to describe it. Would you agree with that? I mean, it's,
Oh yeah. I mean, I said it the same way, you know, that, you know, it's like with the Shemitah, you know, when you get to that day, the last one, it's like the fingerprints of God and the marks of seven were all over the place. I mean, how much more clearer can you get on the exact day appointed by God at the end of the seventh year, 7 years from the last one exactly to the day, on the day when 7% is wiped out of the market, 777.7, and now this. I mean, I didn't originally see this, but this, literally the secular world picked up on this without knowing the Shemitah.
This kind of authenticates what you've been writing about and speaking about in ways that you could have never expected, at least in my view.
No.
Fantastic.
No, and you can't. You know, yeah. And now as far now to go to the mystery of the Shemicha as opposed to the Shemitah, and that's in the book. Really, and you know, there's so much there, and it's one of the things I have not heard, and it's there, and it's so clear once you see it. One of the mysteries of the Bible, you know, before a sacrifice could be lifted up, there had to be something performed, a specific ritual performed on the sacrifice that's called the Shemicha. And that is this, the priest would have to take his hands, literally the palms of his hands, and place it on the head of the sacrifice and identify, in a sense he becomes one with the sacrifice, so the sacrifice can die for his sins. And then he would confess over the sacrifice this, either his sins or the sins of the people. So it was called a smicha. It would be a transference of sin. He'd have to put the palms of his hands on the head of the sacrifice. Now this happened on Yom Kippur, the holiest day of the year, but it happened with every sin offering. Same thing. So always, you cannot offer up the sacrifice until this happened. Well, the Bible says that Messiah, Jesus, is the sacrifice. So could the smicha have been performed? Well, here's the thing. You know, who offers up the sacrifice? The priest do. Where was Messiah taken before he was offered up? To the priest. It's not an accident. The Sanhedrin, they were corrupt. They didn't know what they were doing. But they were delivering the sacrifice. So what did they do? But according to the mystery, the hands of the priest must touch the head of the sacrifice. So what happens is when they took him before the Sanhedrin, the Bible records, when they pronounced judgment, it says the priest, so all there, they started buffeting him. They started striking him with their hands on his head. The hands of the priest had to touch the head of the sacrifice. And literally in the Greek, it says the palms of their hands touched his head. So this is the smicha. But according to the smicha, there has to be a confession of sin onto the sacrifice. Well, was that? Yes. What happened is, at the same moment, the high priest said, he is guilty of blasphemy. Well, according to the smicha, it's not the sacrifice of sin, it's the sins of those who offer him. So they are confessing their own sin. The sin is the sin of the blasphemy is the sin of the high priest, and it's the sin of man. They're representing it. Israel, it's our sin. Man is God from the garden. So here they perform the smicha, and then he's delivered to be offered up. And according to the mystery, and there are many mysteries of the temple in the Book of Mysteries, one of them is that, you know, he is on Yom Kippur, they take the two goats, and they, you know, the priest puts them in front of the people, one on his left side, one on his right side. One of the goats is chosen to be the scapegoat to escape, the other is chosen to be the sacrifice to the Lord. And so what happened before Messiah was offered up? It wasn't two goats, it was two men presented in front of the people. It was Messiah, Jesus, and Barabbas. But he was the other goat. goats, the other life. It's not two goats, it's two human lives. And we always know Barabbas, you know, he's the criminal, and that's like a representation of us. But Barabbas is the one who goes free, and Messiah is the one who dies. But there's a mystery even there. Behind the name Barabbas, in Hebrew, his real name is Baraba. Now, Messiah. Now, according to the ancient rabbis, they said that they recorded that in the temple when this happened, the two goats had to look alike. They had to be identical, so you couldn't tell them apart. Well, Messiah is the son of the Father. Barabbas, Baraba, means the son of the Father. So exactly, even in that, how perfect God is. And the thing is that for us to get saved, any one of us, in order to get saved, you might not have known it, but you have to perform the smicha. You're reaching across time and space, and you're touching Jesus, and you're identifying with him, and you're saying, you died for my sins. You're confessing your sins onto him who already took it. You're performing the smicha. He died, we go free.
Very powerful, Mr. Khan. We're coming up against a break, so we're going to hold off until we come back. Folks, you're listening to Jonathan Khan. His newest book, The Book of Mysteries, is a fascinating read, very powerful, full of mysteries that are unlocked, unsealed, if you will, and shared for all to read. Again, The Book of Mysteries. You can go to www.mysteriesbook.com or go to hopeoftheworld.org or Amazon or your local retailers to pick up this book. Just came out this week, and I have not read through it. My dad has.
Oh,
I've cherry-picked it, as I said. And what I have read and what I've heard from Mr. Khan tonight continues to just build up, and I just want to continue to read it and finish it.
It's really a gift that to me it's just a gift of inspiration and wisdom. Wisdom keeps coming to me. I just keep thinking about the word wisdom. And boy, do I need that, folks. Again, Jonathan Khan is our guest. I want to say this. Do yourself a favor, folks. Give yourself a treat. Find Jonathan Khan's addressing the Congress on Capitol Hill, his speeches on Capitol Hill. Watch those videos.
Also the one given to the UN. I mean, I think he did two separate times, but they're both fascinating.
Yeah. What a marvelous speaker. Jonathan Khan's our guest. You're listening to the Hagman and Hagman Report. Be right back.
Rabbi Jonathan Khan, New York Times bestselling author of The Harbinger and The Mystery of the Shemitah, his latest book, The Book of Mysteries, available at Amazon, Barnes & Nobles, all the retail outlets. You can also go to mysteriesbook.com, and I would urge everybody who is listening and can get the book to get the book, as it is a fantastic read and something that you can continue to read even after you're done reading it.
You know, I couldn't resist jumping in here. I want to tell you, I told Jack, I said his name. That's all right. There's a lot of people named Jack. My neighbor bought the book. Okay. He's on his way over. He's on his way over right now to the studio to borrow. He thinks he's going to borrow my copy. He's going to buy a copy. That's what he's going to do. Go ahead.
We got one segment left with Rabbi Khan, and we're going to continue to dig into some of these mysteries that he has in the book. Jonathan, we got about 26 minutes left in the segment. I don't want to take away from the important message that you're trying to bring here today. So I'm going to turn it over to you and let you get into some of the important mysteries that you want to get into in this book.
Okay. Well, okay. And feel
or
free,
any
you know,
question.
In every way. another stream, I would say, of mysteries are that you'll find in the book of mysteries is the mysteries of Eden, and that is that from the beginning, you know, you see the end, and there's a link between those things, and you know, you see it and there's so many of it. You see it, for instance, you know, we all have the picture from the Bible of the Lord wearing the crown of thorns. Why did he do that? Well, it goes back to Eden. The symbol of the curse was the thorns that come up from the earth. Thorns and thistles will bear it. So what is the crown of thorns? It's that he becomes the king of the curse, that the curse comes comes upon him. He's the king of our burdens. He's the king of our sorrows, all those things. Now, why did he even die, you know, on Friday? You know, what was that about? Well, it's because in the Hebrew, it's not just Friday. It's the Friday is the sixth day. Man was created on the sixth day, and so therefore man is redeemed on the sixth day. And, you know, get a little deep here, you know, on the sixth day, God created man in his image. But on the sixth day, what happened in redemption? On that Friday, what happened is they beat God. You know, man, they depicted, they made him look like a sinner. They made him deformed, and they made him look like a fallen man, like a fallen Adam. Well, because if the sixth day God created man in his image, on the sixth day, 2,000 years ago, man created God in his image. He made him into the image of sin. And then on the sixth day, God brought man, he placed him in a garden. On the sixth day, 2,000 years ago, man placed God in a garden tomb. A garden of life or a garden of death. A garden of life, you know, brings death, and the garden of death brings life. And one of the things that and there's so much there, but it's just how perfect God is from the beginning to the end. That's why, you know, the mysteries, it begins in Genesis, ends in Revelation. There are things that go right together. Only God could put that together. I mean, there are, you know, the fact is, you know, we know that when Messiah died, the veil was torn in two. But what, you know, but if you remember, when man was thrown out of the garden, the cherubim were set up to block the way, to be barriers because of sin. So they blocked the way. Well, but people don't realize throughout the temple, on every veil and every barrier, there was, it wasn't just a barrier, but the cherubim were placed on every barrier. And so when Messiah died and that veil was torn in two, the cherubim were torn apart. It was as if it was Messiah, it was God entering Eden. He was coming back through, like passing through the cherubim, that the way is open, the way is clear, and that goes, that, as you say, dovetails with all the mysteries of the rabbis, that was the moment that everything changed. It's all there, you know. And when Messiah rose, he did it on a Hebrew feast. You know, something I didn't, when I wrote the Book of Mysteries, I wanted, there's another thing about it, I don't say this, but if you actually read it, you don't have to, but because the days are not dated, they're numbered, so you can read, you can start any time of the year. But if you started in January is day one, when you get to the time of the holy days on the biblical calendar, it's going to correspond with the biblical calendar. So when there's a Hebrew feast, there's going to be something, a mystery related to that feast. And so, and there were times that actually happened without even me doing it. There were three cases where we didn't even do it, and it was on the exact day, but the mystery is on the day. But the day that Messiah rose, it wasn't just a day. There's so much we miss because we many believers don't know the calendar of God, and that is that he rose on the day called, there's a day called Yom Reshit, the day of the first fruit, when it's the beginning of new life, when their priests are lifting up the new life of the harvest and saying the winter is over, it's all gone, the new life begins on this day. That's on that day that Messiah rose, on Yom Reshit, the day of the first fruit. But there's even more to that mystery, because the very first word of the Bible, I mean, it says Bereshit, in the beginning. In Hebrew, in the beginning, beginning is the word Reshit. Well, the day that Messiah rose is called the day of the Reshit. In other words, the word the beginning also means the first fruit. So therefore, Jesus, when the rabbis had to translate this into Greek, they looked at this word Reshit, the beginning book, and they gave the Greek name, they called it Genesis. So the day that Jesus rose, get this, the resurrection day, is really the Hebrew day of Genesis. It's the day of the beginning. It's the day of the new creation. It's the day when everything begins again, where everything before it is as if it didn't exist. That's how amazing God is, and there's so much in that as well. And you know, but let me take you to another sample of another thing here, and that is it's called the mystery of the wolf. And in the book, the teacher and the student are watching a shepherd at night, or like, I think it's as night falls, and behind, then they notice behind, trailing it, is a wolf. One of the mysteries in the Bible is that of the wolf, and that is God is the shepherd, you know, Messiah is the good shepherd, and the enemy is likened to a wolf, false prophets, or the wolf comes to destroy. But then add the other puzzle piece, the Jewish people are called the flock of God, and so is the church, spiritually. But the Jewish people are called the flock of God. Well, what happens if a flock is separated from its shepherd? Well, it's going to scatter. It's going to scatter all over. What you want to see the proof of Jesus? Look at Jewish history. The Jewish people are called the flock. When they have what happened without the shepherd, without their Messiah, they have scattered all over the world like sheep without a shepherd. And what happens when that happens? They become vulnerable to the wolf, to the predators. And it is actually a prophecy in Ezekiel that speaks about this. It says, my flock was scattered, and all the beasts of the field they preyed on them and tore them. And well, that's all there. That's Jewish history. I mean, the last 2,000 years, that's this cosmic. A mystery happening out. But who are the worst or the most wolf-like? Who are the worst enemies or predators of the Jewish people? The Nazis, without any question. But mm-hmm. There's a mystery there, and that is that if you look, and I found this only, I was looking at this recently, that if you look at the names of the Nazi leaders and many of the Nazis, you'll find that the one who was the mentor of Hitler, one of his, you know, his inspiration, his name was Wolf. The one who came up with the name Nazi was, his name in German meant Wolf. Hitler's secretary was named Johanna Wolf. Many of the highest, the SS were called, their names meant the Wolf, all throughout. And Hitler, what did he make his headquarters? It was called the Wolf Slayer. It was called the another one was called Werewolf. You know, he directed, he spoke of himself as a wolf that was destined to attack the sheep, which is the Jewish people. But not only that, there was a child born in Austria, you know, in the late 1900s or 1800s, and his name, and they gave him a name. The name was Adolphus or Adolf. Adolf means the wolf. So you want to see how real God is and how real the enemy is? You know, this is, and how satanic that is. There's a real wolf, which is the enemy, and there's a real hatred for God. You see that with the Holocaust. It's satanic. But at the same time, when Hitler was destroyed, you know, when a shepherd destroys the wolves, then he can gather the flock back. And that's exactly what happens. When the Nazis were destroyed, when Hitler was destroyed, that's when he gathered Israel back into the world. So there are mysteries in the book of not only the light, but also knowing how to deal with the enemy as well. You know, and speaking of that, let me throw in something for you guys, and this is something that's going to happen next week here around where I am. And talk about harbingers. In the harbinger, that again, the template is ancient Israel falling away from God. But when they fell away from God, they didn't just fall away from God. They turned to the worship of another god, and the other god is the god Baal. He's the pseudo god. He's the substitute for God. He's the god of their apostasy. When you turn away from God, in one way or another, you're turning to Baal. In fact, the name from Baal, we get the word Beelzebul, which is the word for Satan. So could we, you know, Baal? Could we see in America? Could the sign of Baal actually appear? Well, there was you probably guys were, because you're really up on things. You're probably aware that in the spring there was a plan to do something. It got canceled. But what people don't realize, it has been revived, and that is to put up in on American soil the arch that led to the Temple of Baal. It is to be put up where? In New York City, the place of 9/11. And so here, and it's been rescheduled, it is to go up this coming week, next Monday. They are going to erect the arch that led the worshipers of Baal to the Temple of Baal on American soil in New York City. And they are rebuilding actually what ISIS destroyed. Now, in the Harbinger, when they said, we will rebuild, they're actually rebuilding what the Assyrians destroyed. Well, the children of the Assyrians are ISIS, not only in spirit, but even in blood. So we're actually now rebuilding what the Assyrians, this is the exact thing of the Harbinger. And the people are doing it, saying, we're doing this as a sign of defiance. When the Harbinger happened, you know, undoubtedly the temples of Baal and the shrines of Baal in Israel were destroyed, and they sought to rebuild it. Well, we're now doing the exact thing. If I'm able to, I'm going to actually go to New York City on that day and see what happens. But talk about harbingers. We literally are building the arch to the Temple of Baal.
You want us to go with you? How can this be? I understand the mindset to some extent, but are we that blinded And I, that, that's really, that's not a rhetorical question. Are we that blinded? Are our leaders that blinded? Are the people who are behind this that blinded? Or is it something different? Is, are they nefarious in nature?
I think my feeling is, I mean, look at the harbingers and you look at, you know, why did they do what they did? Why did Tom Daschle pronounce a judgment on America, you know, for using the ancient judgment of Israel? He didn't know what he was doing. You know, he did it. You know, why did Obama inscribe the words of, in a sense, of the vow of judgment on the tower there in New York City? Why, he didn't realize what he was doing, you know, and that's the pattern. But neither did ancient Israel know. You know, when Isaiah records that they said these words, you know, we will rebuild, we'll come back stronger, they're pronouncing judgment on their nation, but they don't realize what they're doing. So I don't think they realize it. I mean, there's a spiritual thing behind it. They're in their spirit, perhaps, but they don't realize it. But the harbingers manifest because they must manifest. And this, too. I mean, they have no idea what they're doing. And yet, it's all madam. Now we have the actual arch of the God of the time of the harbingers, you know, doing the same act again. So it's all happening. And you know, we see the outside, but we see what we see in the news, and we see the apostasy, but it's actually the signs are manifesting. And speaking of signs, let me throw out another one, you know, from the Book of Mysteries, and that is that there's a time when the teacher takes the disciple into the desert, and he draws a sign in the sand. And the thing is that there is, you know, when the Jewish people were saved on Passover, you know, they were saved by putting blood, of course, on the doorposts of their house. And what they did is they had to put it on the top, and they had to put it on the left side and the right side. And so it was blood on the beams of their door, the doorpost. And if you look at that, it forms, connecting the dots, literally, and that's what the teacher does in the Book of Mysteries, it forms a triangle of blood, of the Lamb's blood, from going upward from man to God, going upward to heaven. Well, God is so awesome that over 1,000 years later, God answers it. And again, and it's on the same day, Passover, Messiah dies for our sins. He is the Lamb of God. And on the beams of wood now, it was the beams of their doorpost, but now it's the beams of the cross. On those beams are 3 points of blood, the blood of the Lamb, marking it again. And what does it form? One on his left hand, one on his right hand, one on his feet. And what does that form? A triangle. Another triangle answering the other triangle. But the first triangle is a triangle from going upward to heaven, from earth to heaven, man to God. The second triangle is from heaven to earth, pointing downward from God to man. But there's more, because if you put the triangles together, it forms a cosmic Star of David. So even that, God is so perfect and so amazing, and so, you know, and that's just one. That's called, in the book, it's called The Mystery of the Triangles. Now, there's something, again, I said several end-time mysteries. One is called the House of Spirits, and this is when the teacher takes the disciple to a kind of ruins of a once great house, and wind is blowing through it, and what he tells them is something that most believers know as a sort of a parable, and they think about, well, this is about somebody being possessed, but it's deeper than that. When the Lord gave this picture, he said when the man is basically possessed and he has a spirit in him, but then he's delivered from that, but then he kind of turns, the implication, he turns away from God again, and instead of, and now he was all cleaned up, and now 7 spirits come back, and so it's worse than it was at the beginning for him, because he was cleansed by God, then he turned back. Well, we think about that as something speaking about possession, and it is, but that's really not what Messiah was saying. As the primary thing, he said, such is this generation. He's not speaking about one person. He's speaking about a whole civilization. Well, here's the thing, and here's a mystery that people don't realize that is so relevant to now, and that is that what happened is to civilization, Western civilization was once totally pagan, totally demonically possessed, and, you know, with the gods and all that. Then the gospel came, and it cleansed West, it cleansed them of much of these demonic things, and it became like a civilization that had been swept of all these things. But the thing is this, here's the thing, if that civilization turns back to darkness, if it turns away from God and the gospel, then its end will be 7 times worse than the beginning. It will be 7 times more evil than it was in the beginning. It will become seven more times demonic than it was. And that's why, you know, between a pre-Christian civilization and a post-Christian civilization, it's the post-Christian civilization that we're witnessing that is far more dangerous. In pre-Christian, you might have a Caligula and a Nero and crazy people. But in a post-Christian, you get a Hitler. You get a Stalin. You get an Antichrist. And this is really linked to the Antichrist as well. You know, so that's what we're witnessing. Those are the stakes what we're witnessing. And speaking of the end times, another end time thing linked to this is that at one point there's a mystery called the fourth creature, and that where the teacher around a campfire has a scroll and he's explaining the vision of Daniel, and of course it says, you know, the three creatures, and there was a fourth. The three creatures represent the great kingdoms, but the fourth creature represents the end time kingdom, the last civilization. But one thing we don't know, if you read in English, it says the fourth creature was different from the others. But in Hebrew, the word is shaneh. And that doesn't just mean different. It means altered. It can mean, it can imply unnatural. You know, and what it's saying is the civilization of the end times is going to be not only different from any other, it's going to be unnatural. It's going to be altered. It's going to be away from the natural order of things, you know, and I kind of alluded to that with the apostasy. It's going to be an artificial civilization, like, you know, you actually see with that beast, you see metal in it, and not just animal things. So even in the one Hebrew word, it gives us a whole revelation of what we are witnessing right now before our eyes.
Fantastic.
I'll give you another one.
Oh, wow.
And the other thing, many of the mysteries also are to lead you to find the destiny, your calling, to change your life. And one of the big things people say, and this more goes with the mystery of each of us, say, well, how can I find God's will for my life? How do I fulfill my calling? What is my calling? You know, do I go to the left? Do I go to the right? Where do I go? What do I, you know? And there, in one of the mysteries, called The Way to the Mountaintop, the teacher takes the disciple to a mountain, and he says, you know, you have to get to the top. There's something waiting for you at the top, at this one exact spot, and you have to go there. And then the student looks and he sees all these different paths. He says, well, which one do I go? Which path leads to the top? And he says, well, that's for you. That's what you have to find out. So he starts going up the mountain, starts, you know, heading up on one path, and then he has to make a turn. Then he goes on another path and another path, and he ends up being lost, and it's dark, and he ends up going down and shouting, and he ends up at the bottom of the mountain, and he says, I couldn't do it. And the teacher then explains the key, gives him the key, because it's also, the book is about the keys to overcome and finding your calling and overcoming. So what happens at that moment, the teacher tells him a mystery, and that is this. In order to go to Jerusalem, and everybody had to go to Jerusalem back then, you had to go up because Jerusalem was up. And so every time you read in the New Testament, it says Jesus went up to Jerusalem. It always says up because he had to go up. And the journey had a name. It was called Aliyah. And that means the upward journey. When the Jewish people returned to Israel, it was called Aliyah. It was the upward journey. And so the thing is this. We are all heading, ultimately, every child of God is heading to Jerusalem, to the heavenly Jerusalem. Therefore, we must be, our life must be a journey of Aliyah. It must be an upward journey. And the key to finding your destiny, more than, well, do I go right, do I go left, which is it, Lord? Well, the ultimate key is this. Every day, you're going to have a choice between going upward or downward. You're going to go higher in the Lord, lower. You're going to have choices to become more spiritual, less spiritual, more godly, more ungodly, more loving, more selfish. You're to resist the sin or give in to that sin. And every day you have that choice. The key is you have to make Aliyah. Every day, choose the higher step no matter what. And what's going to happen is, if you keep doing that every day of your life, you're going to end up, because if you're on that, you're going up a mountain, you're going to end up at the exact peak, at the exact point, and we're usually the center of the mountain. It's almost like if you could look from heaven and you look at in the middle of that peak is God's perfect will for your life, your destiny. No matter where you start on the mountain, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter where, how far you are away from God, doesn't matter at all. If you keep following this principle, whether you're on the left or on the right, you're going to end up in the exact appointed moment and exact appointed destiny and calling for your life. And you're going to intersect with the path that's the perfect path for your life. And so it's an absolute thing. How do you find God's will? There's something called the Josiah mystery, and that is Josiah, we don't know that he knew exactly what God's will was for his life, but he ended up on the exact mountain where they said, Josiah, it was prophesied hundreds of years ago that you would be here this day on this mountain. He found his destiny, but he didn't know it. And the key is Josiah, what he did, he knew one thing. He knew God's will. And every day he followed the will of God. That's it. Every day. The key is, follow the will of God that you know from the Bible, and it will lead you to the will of God that you don't know. Obey the will of God in your life, what you already know, and it's going to lead you to the perfect appointed destiny of the will of God for your life.
Amen. Wow. Powerful. Mr. Khan, in the remaining few minutes we have left, I'd just like to grant you the latitude to speak on anything, to touch anything. Take it wherever you want to go, because there's no question we can ask, in my view, right now, that could be better asked, or could be asked where I guess, just take us where you'd like to go, wherever the Spirit is leading you.
Yeah,
in the last few minutes.
A few things. Let me do it from a prophetic thing, and then also how that intersects with the Book of Mystery. So, we are, you know, and I know you guys sense it. I know you guys are on top. And by the way, I really applaud your work. It's always a joy. You know, there's a lot of interviews I can't do because just for time, but it's a joy always to be with you, and for what you're doing in the Lord and for this hour. We're at a very critical point, you know, and I mean, not only politically, but in every way. We're seeing things we never dreamed. Well, we knew by prophecy, but otherwise it would be mind-boggling. We're seeing things on television we could never imagine. We're seeing the end times. We're seeing the last days. We're seeing the signs of persecution. We're seeing the things that we're seeing America morph, transform into something we could hardly have imagined. It's all there in the Bible. It's all there, but we're seeing it. And so we have to, we sing the days, like these are the days of Elijah. And, you know, we sing that, but the days of Elijah were days of apostasy and days of persecution of God's people. And so if we are singing these are the days of Elijah, then we must become the Elijahs of the day. God is not finished, no matter what it looks like. People ask me, what's coming, judgment or revival? There can be both, and there can be and it can come through shaking. But we have to be prepared. What we are witnessing in some of the mysteries in the book that deal with the end times, it's not just darkness in the end times, it's polarization. The dark gets darker, the lights have to get brighter. And so this can be the greatest time for your life and for the life of God's people, if we will respond, if we will rise to it, if we will stand. We can be the greatest times in our life. It can be the greatest times in the church. You know, even if it's less people following, those people will be more like the Book of Acts. One of the mysteries in the book is called the chiasma, and I won't go into it, but it's an ancient Greek word, but it has to do with the fact that the end of the age is matched to the beginning, will be like the beginning. In the beginning, you had Israel in the world, you got Israel back. Beginning, you had Jerusalem, you got Jerusalem back. In the beginning, you had Jewish believers, you got them back. You had Jew and Gentile, you had a church coming to close to join to its Jewish roots, you're getting that back. But you also had persecution back then, an anti-Christian world culture, you're getting that back too. But what God wants to do is bring the Book of Acts back. And so the best could be yet ahead, no matter what happens in the world. So that is why, and that is why I wrote the Book of Mysteries. That's why I was led to get this to God's people, to not only reveal these things or open these things from God, God is awesome. Again, never stop seeking him. You'll see there's no end to it, and there's so much more to know than we already knew. There's so much more for us to know of God. That's why I wrote that. But really, to strengthen his people, because we're going to have to be strong. We're going to have to be plugged into God more than ever, and God will anoint. You know, it says the eyes of the Lord search the entire earth looking for the one whose heart is his. Be that one. So the Book of Mysteries is for that. It's a tool. It's a vessel for that reason. And that's why, and I'm really blessed, you know, because you guys, obviously you take things seriously. You've been reading it. And that's what you told me during this time. There couldn't have been anything better that I heard. So, you know, it's everywhere. It just came out, and you can get it from Walmart to Amazon to every other place. But it's there, and you'll recognize it because the cover looks like it's one of those books that that you would find in the desert, one of those mystery books that when you see it, it'll look like an ancient book on there. So you recognize it. So it's everywhere. And it's also, but also, I don't know if I mentioned it, it's also to give to unbelievers, because at the end it tells you how to get saved, and it's to draw unbelievers in too. So I believe it's going to be a tool not only to minister, but also to give to unsaved people as well as saved people. So it's really everywhere. And, you know, and I thank you guys, are great.
God bless you. Thank you, Mr. Khan. We will be promoting your book every day. I mean, this is a fantastic work. Thank you so much for your gift of time. Do come back.
Thank you, guys. And keep up the great work, and I will. God bless.
All right. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Jonathan.
Going to be right back. Stay right there.